In 1933, George Turnbull, a young lecturer in education at the University of Liverpool, received a letter from a London law firm. Opening it with some trepidation, the letter contained, instead of a legal demand, some surprising news. It's now turned on. The letter explained that on the 13th of November 1931, Hugh Cholmondeley, the third Baron Delamere and founder of the scandalous Happy Valley set of British East Africa, had passed away at his Kenyan estate. His son, also based in Kenya, had promptly decided to dismember some of the family's English possessions from the traditional estate at Vale Royal in Cheshire. Among these items was an ungainly 17th century wooden chest. When this box was opened and inspected by Cholmondeley's lawyers, it was revealed to contain several papers relating to the endeavours of a certain S. Hartlib. Turnbull had received this letter because in 1920 he had published a pamphlet concerning the activities of the Prussian intelligencer Samuel Hartlib, who spent the majority of his working life as an information broker in London. In this work, based on the Hartlibiana preserved in the British Museum Library, Turnbull had speculated on the ultimate fate of Hartlib's larger personal archive, concerning which he had found some tantalizing references. After taking possession of the chest with the permission of its owner in 1933, Turnbull was delighted to find within it 68 neat bundles of paper consisting of some 22,000 leaves of documents, stemming indeed from Hartlib's personal collection. Turnbull confidently declared that what he then had in his possession was probably all of Hartlib's remaining papers. Turnbull himself went on to write numerous articles exploring the bequest, as well as a remarkable book, Hartlib Durian Comenius, Gleanings from Hartlib's Papers, published in 1947, which remains the best overall introduction to the content of Hartlib's archive. After Turnbull's 1961 death, the papers passed to the Sheffield University Library and became available for general study. But as this study progressed, it became clear that Turnbull's declaration was premature. In several important works, Charles Webster probed the archive in conjunction with Hartlibiana he discovered elsewhere, and as part of Sheffield University's Digital Hartlib Papers project, which ran between 1988 and 2002, Director Mark Greengrass spent a year pursuing fugitive Hartlib material in European libraries, returning with a bounty of some 500 additional documents, which he duly published. Both researchers recognized, however, that what was extant constituted but a fraction of Hartlib's original archive. As part of the Cultures of Knowledge project, I've been working intensively with Hartlib's remaining archive in order to produce a calendar of his correspondence. While doing so, I've become keenly aware of the haphazard nature of the transmission of this archive, and have been given pause to consider how chance descents of documents can impact on historical reputations. As Michael Hunter has pointed out, in the past there has been something of a tendency to accept stray letter books or surviving archivalia at face value, without questioning how genealogies of prominence or the capriciousness of the compilers and custodians can impact on the survival and content of such collections, and as such, on our view of their subjects. In this paper, I seek to answer a simple question, that being how large was Hartlib's archive? But the significance of this question is not simply related to its answer. Whether Hartlib wrote and received 5,000 letters is of interest only to the keenest number cruncher. Rather, by asking the question, we are forced to reconsider our perceptions concerning the history of Hartlib's archive and the nature of its composition, its preservation, and its impact. I should emphasize that today I'm concerned with Hartlib's correspondence and not with other material that once formed part of his collection, tracts and notes and alchemical recipes and so forth. So when I refer to the archive, I therefore mean the correspondence archive in abstract. This paper will be structured in three parts. Firstly, I will briefly demonstrate the state of Hartlib's extant correspondence before considering how much material may no longer be extant. Secondly, I will provide an account of the surprising history of Hartlib's archive and those who helped to shape it. In the conclusion, I will briefly sketch out some of the implications of these findings. Hartlib was born around 1600 in Elbing, Prussia, to a German father and an English mother. He was educated in Brieg, in Königsberg, and in Cambridge. And in 1628, Hartlib fled conflict in the Baltic and settled ultimately in London with the initial goal of assisting fellow continental exiles. Between around 1632 and his death in 1662, Hartlib engaged in a dedicated campaign of correspondence, which accommodated strivings in pedagogy, prophecy, medicine, politics, chemistry, care of the poor, husbandry, zoology, and yet other fields. He appears to have consciously begun preserving papers around 1635. His ultimate, if quixotic, goal was by various means to institute a universal reformation of arts and sciences for the betterment of humankind. Concerning his correspondence, at present we possess parts of 4,895 unique letters written by members of Hartlib's circle, or originating from within his archive. This is Hartlib's extant correspondence, nearly 3,600 pieces to or from Hartlib are preserved, just slightly over 25% is third-party correspondence, which nevertheless originated from within his collections, being scribal copies, extracts, or indeed documents that he archived personally. Very similar numbers demonstrate that this material, the majority of it, 3,484 pieces, is in Sheffield University archives, while just over 1,400 pieces can be found in other institutions and in contemporary printed books. Breaking down the material that's beyond Sheffield University, we can see that the majority of it is in, or a large part of it is in, the British Library. But a surprising amount is preserved in early printed books, with other deposits in the Royal Society Archive, among Boyle's papers, Yale University Library, which we'll hear more about later, where a bundle of Hartlib's material reached, and even in the Bodleian Library there are quite a few little bits and pieces. I speak of bundles from the Hartlib archive because this is how his papers were arranged. They were tied up with string. Mainly they were letters and other documents that were relevant from the same correspondent or on the same topic. And they're easily identifiable by the organization. You often have multiple copies of the same letter, for example, following in sequence one after the other. Most of the bundles, 71 of them, are in Sheffield. However, you also have two bundles here at the Bodleian Library. You have one important bundle in the Beinecker Library in Yale, and 14 bundles in the British Library that I would be confident to suggest emerged from Hartlib's archive. Great. Geographically, Hartlib's correspondence were well spread. There is a single letter at its westerly extent from William White on the island of Barbuda, and its most easterly point is Batavia in the Dutch East Indies, where Hartlib received a letter from Andrew Dury, the brother of John Dury. There are also letters from Constantinople from Georg Gentius to Hartlib, and one survivor from the Adriatic island of Zant by the Quaker John Perrow. For the most part, however, Hartlib's correspondence partners could be found tightly clustered in reformed northern Europe. And this is a mapping of the location of his correspondence partners. It excludes those partners in England. There were quite a few of them. However, we can basically see the distribution of the correspondence, a large cluster in the United Provinces, The Hague, Amsterdam, Arnhem, Hamburg, and of course in the in Elbing, Danzig, and Königsberg, the area where Hartlib originated from. There's also quite a few in Paris, where Oldenburg and various others were located. This we can contrast with another intelligence of the 17th century, Peresque, who, you know, being a Frenchman, mainly his correspondents were located in the territories of France. Ismail Bolio, on the other hand, has a rather more cosmopolitan distribution of correspondence, and Hartlib and Peres can't really match him in that respect. Okay. So, at 3,594 letters, Hartlib's extant personal correspondence is roughly equal to that of the other major 17th century intelligences like Beaulieu, Peresque, and Oldenburg, although the ratio of incoming to outgoing correspondence is alarmingly high in Hartlib's material. Similar too are the number of individual correspondents of each intelligencer, usually between 400 and 500. But despite the impressive size, the geographical scope, and the diversity of Hartlib's correspondence, again, what survives is but part of a once much larger archive. But how might we determine the size of this original collection? Previous attempts to estimate the size of incomplete archives have been extrapolated mostly according to rates of correspondence based on surviving documents. As such, these calculations were largely subject to the limitations of the processes of archival transmission itself. To reconstruct Hartlib's correspondence, I wanted to adopt a more robust formula, which would be able to somewhat peer past these limitations. The key to this was to examine the content of the archive itself, and not simply the number of surviving letters. Although we, unlike in the case of the Boyle papers, say, possess no inventories, evidence concerning the former size of Hartlib's archive can be found throughout the papers. In Hartlib's diary, for example, which mentions intelligence not gathered from London visitors nor communicated in extant letters, and in those large gaps in Hartlib's numerical notations in the headers of correspondence of certain partners, which suggest loss of intervening epistles. But the evidence is most prominent in the surviving letters themselves, in which reference is frequently made to further letters to and from Hartlib which are no longer extant. It was these references which form my starting point for calculating the size of Hartlib's personal correspondence. And here it is again. In order to assist me with exploiting this data, I turned to a mathematician in Hartford College, Luis Fernando Alde, to help formulate an equation which would provide an average base indication of the size of the original archive. Now, this doesn't take into consideration the third-party correspondence, but only Hartlib's personal correspondence itself. Although we are able to factor in Hartlib's archiving practice into the final result. We were guided by several principles which determined the size, sample, and nature of the calculation. The method employed was graph theory to plot the correspondence. In essence, it had to be explained to me about 8 times before I understood it, and I still don't, but then it was shown to me in a very simple diagram, and I kind of understand what's happening now. Basically, we have a group of letters, and in these letters, reference is occasionally made to other letters. Thank you for yours of the 24th of March, etc. Some of these letters exist, others no longer exist. So this letter here may have a reference to a letter of the 24th of March, which is no longer extant. It may also have a reference to a letter from the 9th of April, which is extant. Similarly, this letter might contain similar references, so too this one. Basically, in order to produce this average, we have to calculate the number of arrows pointing to no longer extant letters and compare them with the arrows pointing to extant letters which are in our sample. In order to do this, we took a sample of 10% of Hartlib's personal correspondence, or 360 pieces. These were adopted from randomly chosen but contiguous 3-month blocks between 1631 and 1661. The reason why the time blocks are important is because if you take letters at random, say one from 1660 and then one from 1642, the chances of actually getting a reference to a letter that is still extant is rather small. Indeed, and 3 months as well is enough time for, you know, a letter. The idea the letter will be mentioned only relatively shortly after being sent. Only letters and scribal copies were considered. We excluded drafts, extracts, notes, views, incomplete letters. Also excluded were undated letters. Unclear references to further correspondence were also excluded because they may or may not be present in the chosen sample. And excluded references in letters... we excluded references in letters in which the sender or the recipient is unidentified. A disadvantage of this process is that the limited survival rate of Hartlib's outgoing correspondence influences results upward. An advantage is that not all correspondence is referred to in the letters. Now, the equation to work out this particular problem is that the number of letters in total will equal the sample size multiplied by the number of outgoing arrows in the sample, which is x, divided by the number of ingoing arrows in the sample, the number of references to letters which are still extant, which is y. Now, the results were somewhat surprising. In the sample of 360 letters that we had, there were 342 references to non-extant letters. There were additionally references to only 12 extant letters, which is a low ratio. This means that the average total of Hartlib's archive is 10,440 letters, which strikes me as high. We then ran a simulation. Luis Fernando created a program which incorporated the deviation of plus or minus 10%, not 9%, in extant and non-extant letter ratio. The average personal correspondence was calculated at 9,206 items. Assuming a ratio of, Hartlib, as we saw before, archived about 25% of third-party correspondence. If we add 25% according to that ratio of 9,206, then the archive may have been as big as 11,508. items. But generally, we've come to the conclusion that about 42% of the original archive is extant, certainly less than 50%. How does this compare to other early modern intelligences? Well, nobody is touching Peresk, who's the heavyweight undisputed champion, but Hartlib is certainly up there with Beaulieu, and I note that Oldenburg is kind of lagging behind, but I am aware that there are many more letters out there. Okay, so easily damaged, dissipated, or destroyed, archives are of course subject to interventions so unique and unpredictable that no algorithm or equation can possibly anticipate or accommodate them. So how is it that most of Hartlib's archive came to be lost today? There are of course many reasons. Generally, letters as a category of document tend to be archivally promiscuous, and as scraps of paper are prone to getting lost or becoming uncommonly useful fire starters. Much of Hartlib's archival penumbra of outgoing epistles, most dedicated to itinerant Central Europeans, was probably already lost during the turmoils of the 17th century. Much of the rest, such as this tantalizing collection formerly in the Elbing Stadtbibliothek, City Library, never made it past World War II. Some epistles faced more benign, but no less damaging challenges from archival predators like autograph collectors. And major 19th century collections of William Upcott, Dawson Turner, and Alfred Morrison, each of whom amassed autograph collections of more than 30,000 items, all contain multiple pieces of Hartlibiana, some as many as five or six. While a handful of unique letters to or from Hartlib survive solely on account of these autograph collections, many more have been lost because of them. The dissipation of the letters in Hartlib's own possession, however, began already during his lifetime. Some of this is due to Hartlib's own practice as an auto-archivist. The reasoning behind some of his own actions in the archive is clear, as for example, his disposal of letters which he printed in whole or in part in his several edited collections, evidently deeming the manuscripts to be superfluous. Other actions are more opaque. It is unclear, for example, why more than 200 extracts from the letters of Joachim Pohlmann exist, each carefully numbered and keyed to the original complete letter, and yet none of the originals are anywhere to be found in the archive. It seems that the majority of losses, however, were due to factors outside of Hartlib's influence. Most occurred during his illness-plagued final years between 1659 and 1662. During this time, he suffered terribly from kidney, gall, and bladder stones, and at the end of 1660, a fit of the palsy, as he wrote, left him effectively bedridden. Hartlib's house in Axe Yard, Westminster, was large and taxed at some 8 hearths, and was populated by a diverse and ever-changing cast of visitors and lodgers. Not all had the best intentions, and several apparently took advantage of Hartlib's incapacity to pilfer his possessions at will. Upon visiting Hartlib's house in July 1661, for example, an outraged Samuel Wartensky found that Hartlib's papers, utensils, and even furniture had become a prey and a plunder to all, while Hartlib lay prone in a back room. The papers themselves evidently contained intelligence, schemata, recipes, and experiments of some commercial value, so there can be little wonder that this material was desirable to his contemporaries. Equally, the archive no doubt contained much politically sensitive material which, so soon after the Restoration, certain parties felt best to liberate. Following Wartensky's warning, later in 1661, Hartlib apparently entrusted the bulk of his papers to a third party, with whom he hoped they would be secure. This manoeuvre, however, would prove disastrous. In a letter to John Worthington that November, Hartlib revealed that, to compound his physical torments, "the wretched man where all my books stood, having suffered with a world of other manuscripts, distraction or embezzlement, so that I cannot as yet tell what is remaining or not, the catalogues themselves being lost or made away. This is one of the greatest and sorest evils which hath befallen my tormented and afflicted condition." This comment indicates that Hartlib presided over a highly organized and considerable collection. We unfortunately have no further clues concerning the identity of the embezzler or embezzlers, nor him to whom Hartlib had entrusted the manuscripts. The loss of the catalogues is one of the chief reasons why we have such a poor idea today about the size and organizational principles of the archive. The papers that remained in Hartlib's own hands, however, would fare as poorly as those he stored elsewhere. In February of 1662, Hartlib reported to John Worthington that it had pleased God to visit my chamber with a very sad and fearful accident of fire, begun when his stepson, undoubtedly performing an alchemical experiment, overheated indiscriminately my iron stove. Concerning this incident, however, there is no direct mention of manuscript loss. Yet, Hartlib remarked, many of my things were spoiled. Despite Hartlib's coyness, this spoilage was probably substantial. Only shortly before this incident, in October 1661, what John Worthington had remarked on the many bundles of paper that lined the walls of Hartlib's study, and out of which he implored the intelligencer, while still able, to extract such select passages as would make a silver silvarum, or a collection of memorable things. Hartlib himself, however, was beyond consolation at the loss. On February the 14th, 1662, he wrote, "This may be the last of mine for aught I know, being very much tormented in body and afflicted in mind by reason of that lamentable fire which broke out in my study." This is indeed the last known letter from Hartlib. On Monday, March the 10th, 1662, he passed away. But while Hartlib's story ends here, the adventures of his archive were really only just beginning. Dying without a will, but apparently not insolvent, meant that Hartlib's papers were inherited by one or both of his sons, Friedrich Clodius and Samuel Hartlib Jr. Clodius was a Holzacian alchemist and Hartlib's stepson, possibly and most likely, in fact, undoubtedly the one responsible for the fire in Hartlib's study. According to John Evelyn, Clodius had insinuated himself into Hartlib's acquaintance around 1652. In 1654, Henry Moore stated that, "I cannot think of that misshapen monster Clodius, but I am ready to vomit at his gross, foul villainy." More significant than Clodius's emetic effect on his contemporaries, however, is that he was also involved in dispersing papers from Hartlib's archive. Late in 1661, John Jury condemned Clodius for various misdemeanors, which may have been connected with the coterminous embezzling of Hartlib's papers. Furthermore, in the Boyle Papers of the Royal Society are several letters and copies of letters in Clodius's hand, which originated from within Hartlib's archive, and which seem to have been transmitted to Boyle late in 1661 and early 1662. Of the junior Hartlib, there is much that could be said. He was born around 1631 and was initially trained as an amanuensis for John Dewey, before working for several merchant companies in England and the Netherlands, and later in the Hearth Tax Office. His history is one of numerous transgressions which indeed resulted in a minor contemporary celebrity. At least once he was imprisoned for attacking a member of Parliament, and he was also declaimed as a great engine of corruption for stealing from his customs job in 1667. After famously attempting to solicit Samuel Pepys's wife as a prostitute shortly thereafter, as Pepys tells in his diary, in 1672, Andrew Marvell reported that Sam had fled his debtors into Holland. Unbeknownst to Marvell, Sam was also perhaps hurried along by an arrest warrant issued on account of his seditious speeches for publishing libels issued that same year. Hartlib himself was soon back in England, and the last mention that I found of him is in late 1678. Important for us, however, is evidence which shows that Hartlib Jr. was involved in several endeavours which involved the dispersal of his father's papers. He is mentioned several times as a contact and conduit of information between members of the early Royal Society. In 1664, for example, he transmitted papers on weather glasses between Henry Oldenburg and Robert Boyle. In October 1673, Robert Hooke gave one of William Petty's books to Hartlib, and on the February 28th, 1678, he remarked in his diary that he had borrowed Hartlib's chemical correspondence. This correspondence is almost certainly that of Hartlib Sr. as opposed to Hartlib Jr., and it's interesting to note the continued circulation of Hartlib's papers among society members well after his death. There is further food for thought, however, on the idea of Samuel Hartlib Jr. being involved with early members of the Royal Society. Evidently, he was so closely associated with the activities of this group that he may even have been parodied in Thomas Shadwell's 1676 lampoon of the Royal Society, entitled The Virtuoso. In this work, we encounter a character named Sir Samuel Harty, who was described as a brisk, amorous, adventurous, unfortunate coxcomb, one that by help of humorous, nonsensical bywords takes himself to be a wit, and thereby accords somewhat with the image that we have of young Sam. In any event, the evidence suggests that the boys Hartlib rummaged through and distributed papers from Hartlib's archive at will. Probably in early 1664, however, the bulk of the papers were purchased from them by the Cheshire nobleman William Brereton. Brereton was a founding member of the Royal Society, a correspondent of the senior Hartlib, and a great supporter of the Hartlib family in general. His surviving letters indicate a sincere dedication to Hartlib's projects of establishing Christian societies, as well as helping the indigent by means of projects of agriculture and husbandry. Upon inheriting the familial home at Brereton Green in Cheshire following the death of his debt-ridden father in 1664, Brereton evidently decided to put into practice some of Hartlib's ideas. The heart of this mission was an idea he had ruminated upon as early as 1659, an involved project designed to house, feed, employ, and educate the numerous poor of Cheshire. To this end, between mid-1664 and 1669, he attracted several scientific luminaries to Brereton Hall. Resident there at various times was the mathematician John Pell, another mathematician, Thomas Branker, and the churchman John Worthington. An invitation was even extended by Brereton to Robert Boyle, who never took it up, alas. But if the nature of Brereton's project was distinctly Hartlibian, so too were the core personnel at Brereton Hall. Daniel Hartlib, Samuel Hartlib's young nephew from Danzig, was employed as a personal assistant to Brereton. Rounding out the team was Brereton's personal physician, who we've already met, Hartlib's stepson Friedrich Clodius, who brought along his wife, Mary Hartlib, and two children. A centrepiece, perhaps the centrepiece, of this Hartlibian court was Hartlib's archive itself. We know that the archive was present in Brereton on account of a letter by John Worthington to Nathaniel Ingelow of 1667, in which he remarked, At my late being in Cheshire, I met with two trunks full of Mr. Hartlib papers, in which my Lord Brereton purchased. I thought they had been put in order, but finding it otherwise, I took them out, bestrewed a great chamber with them, and put them into order in several bundles. This comment not only suggests the papers had already been previously ransacked, but also confronts us with an unexpected twist. Worthington found two trunks of Hartlib's papers in 1667, and yet in 1933, George Turnbull only received one. Hartlib's archive may, in fact, have been a little bit greater than our calculations suggest. However, Worthington did not only order the papers, he actively intervened and removed items from them. That he had always intended to meddle with the content of the archive is suggested in a telling reply of Seth Ward to news of Worthington's find, which is up here. "I am very glad that those papers of Mr. Hartlib's are preserved and that they have fallen into your hands," he wrote, "into the hands of someone who is able and disposed to make the best of them." Ward himself, as you can see at the bottom of this quote, was quite happy to have his own letters to Hartlib suppressed. Worthington's interventions in the Hartlib archive were guided by several considerations. Firstly, there were the papers he extracted in order to return them to his friends and colleagues, or to destroy them, such as the no longer extant epistles of Seth Ward. But for one letter which he missed, all of Worthington's own correspondence was removed. Worthington was not the only one to intervene in the papers in this way. William Brereton evidently extracted his letters from the papers. So too did Clodius and Daniel Hartlib, who probably took with him all of those letters from his father, Georg. And another person who removed letters was, of course, John Pell, which explains why several of his communications to Hartlib from Zurich presently populate Pell's papers in the British Library. A second type of intervention by Worthington was occasioned by material considered of intellectual or other value. Worthington makes several remarks following his discovery of Hartlib's papers about finding unprinted or unknown letters of Descartes and Hugo Grotius in the archive, including opinions on Comenius's work. Today, with the exception of a copy of Descartes' opinion on Herbert's De Veritate, which is referenced here in Sloane 417 in the British Library, these epistles are nowhere to be found. Indeed, there is some evidence to suggest that Worthington was somehow involved in furnishing material for an edition of Descartes' letters. At least in this particular extract of a letter of Worthington to Hartlib, he makes a covetous mention of some communications of Elizabeth of Bohemia and Descartes, which may or may not have been in Hartlib's archive. Hartlib's correspondence with other scholarly luminaries, including Joachim Jungius and Johann Friedrich Granovius, are also no longer extant in the archive, although they are mentioned in the letters which do survive. And indeed, I've found some of Granovius's letters in Munich recently. Presumably, these letters too were extracted and lost. A third type of Worthington intervention was conversely occasioned by material apparently jettisoned because of its perceived lack of value. The cover sheet of the Yale bundle, to which I referred earlier, contains a statement in Worthington's hand which reads, "Mixed papers and letters of no great value that I know of." This kind of judgment may also indicate the reason why the majority of Hartlib's prophetic papers, including his correspondence with the likes of the Austrian Kiliast Johann Permeyer, either do not survive or were detached and found their way into other collections by other routes, as they were not valued by those who found them or read them in the archive. On this note, it might be prudent to quickly address here the status of the many Hartlibian bundles in the British Library. Were they dispersed from the main body of Hartlib's archive before or after Worthington's interventions of 1667? On the one hand, these papers are ordered in the same fashion as those which underwent Worthington's meddling and can be found today in Sheffield. That is, that multiple copies of the same letters, and letters from the same authors, are typically gathered together in each bundle. However, as far as I've been able to determine, having spent several hours with these papers, none of the British Library bundles contain headwords or comments in Worthington's hand. which are conversely present throughout the Sheffield and Yale material. It appears likely, therefore, that these papers were already extracted from Hartlib's archive before Brereton purchased it. If this is the case, the prevailing assumption that the state and order of the bundles remaining in Sheffield today stems largely from Worthington is likely in error. When Worthington found the papers, he may have been recombining them instead in a manner similar to Hartlib's original system. In any event, it is undeniable that part of Hartlib's archive was in Cheshire in 1667 and suffered losses there. According to Mark Greengrass, there is, thereafter, no sign that the archive of Hartlib was either read or consulted by anyone until it re-emerged in 1933, when it was lent to Turnbull by Thomas Cholmley, the present Lord Delamere, the then Lord Delamere. But when and how did the archive pass from the Brereton family to the Cholmleys? Greengrass himself speculates that Brereton may have sold the papers to Cholmley in 1668, as he rapidly approached the indigence of those he attempted to alleviate due to inheriting his father's massive debts. This is certainly possible, but one should note that Hartlib's was not the only collection of significant papers in Brereton's possession. Also at the Hall's library were several papers of John Pell, who dwelled in Brereton between 1665 and mid-1669. After Pell's death in January 1686, Robert Hooke informed the Royal Society that Pell's papers were partly in the custody of Dr. Busby and the rest at Brereton in Cheshire. While these were never recovered, we may assume that if Pell's valuable mathematical papers were allowed to reside unmolested in Brereton Hall to 1686, it is highly likely that Hartlib's archive remained there as well, at least until the extinction of the Brereton line in 1722. Alas, contrary to the opinions concerning the peaceful and uninterrupted repose of the Hartlib archive in Cheshire, there is ample evidence which shows that several 19th century hands also intervened in the papers. In the Sheffield archive, there are a series of bundle wrappers in a distinctly 19th century hand, which demonstrate that the papers were examined, annotated, and almost certainly reorganized during that century. This is by far my favorite here, Proposals for Sundry Bubbles from 1633 to 1660, which is a classic bit of phraseology. One of the sheets on which one of these bundle wrappers is written is in fact scribbled on the back of an envelope addressed to Thomas Cholmley, the first Lord Delamere, and postmarked in 1833. However, I have also found evidence that at least one antiquarian, Clarence Hopper, also had access to the Hartlib papers. In an 1858 article concerning Milton's blindness, printed in Notes and Queries, Hopper declared that, "Sometime since, I had the pleasure of discovering the Hartlib correspondence, consisting of some thousands of letters, treatises, and other curious manuscripts, and although my examination was but very cursory, I saw enough to convince myself of the probability of it being a mine for researchers, especially for hitherto unknown particulars touching Milton and his contemporaries, which would amply repay the zealous inquirer into history." In this article, Hopper quotes from two letters of Dury to Hartlib, which are today extant in Sheffield, demonstrating that what he found was indeed the Sheffield archive as we know it. The fact that at least two people, Hopper and our anonymous bundler, had access to Hartlib's archive also raises the possibility of further 19th century interventions, although I have not found any proof of those. I'm thinking in particular that, if antiquarians and others had access to Hartlib's paper, then the ever-present autograph collectors might not have been far behind. But anyway, I can't demonstrate this either way, so it's just speculation. We come full circle in 1933 when George Turnbull enters the picture. But is it possible that material could disappear from the archive even while in Turnbull's possession? The answer seems to be yes. Turnbull was extremely generous in lending out papers from the archive, such as to the American scholar Charles Raven, to whom he sent an original letter of Henry Moore in 1951 for inspection. While this letter ultimately found its way back into the archive, it is easy to see how this practice may have led to some losses. It might, of course, have been much worse. during my time working on this project, I spent 2 months living in Sheffield and working in the library there. And there is a legend which circulates about an Odysseus-like university librarian who, 18 months after Turnbull's death, after Turnbull's 1961 death, endured a perilous road journey from Sheffield to Prestatyn in Wales in order to rescue the archive from Turnbull's widow, who, the legend goes, had considered consigning the papers to a bonfire on account of their bulk. And anyway, to sum up, today I have argued that Hartlib's extant archive represents but a fraction of the original, indeed something less than 50%. As I have highlighted, dispersals occurred at different times and for different purposes, prompted by liquid archival micro-sociologies which crystallized about the papers, and constant threats such as fire. During Hartlib's life and shortly after his death, the archive was subject to the passions of the times, and dispersals occurred on account of the profit, greed, self-interest, and perhaps also fear, for reasons personal and professional. As time passed, such interventions became rarer and more dispassionate. By chance, or so it seems now, the papers were removed from volatile London to sleepy Cheshire, where they remained until the 20th century, and were rediscovered by modern scholars. Later interveners in the archive, that is, after the 17th century, although they undoubtedly influenced the form and shape of the material as we now see it, may not have been responsible for large losses of content. And this is, this pattern is something that may be typical of the trajectory of similar archives, such as those of the Boyle papers or Peresk and Bolliar. With this said, it is not likely that my reassessment today of the size of Hartlib's correspondence will significantly alter our perceptions of him. Indeed, with recent identification of heretofore unknown correspondence members, sober scholars like Georg Gentius, Johann Friedrich Granovius, and wild-eyed millenarians like Johann Permeyer and Ludwig Friedrich Giftheil, Hartlib remains as complex and frustratingly idiosyncratic as ever. But equally, had more of the material from his archive survived, then our viewpoint concerning his enterprises could possibly be very different. Hartlib's status, like that of any historical subject, is intimately connected to the preservation of complex evidence concerning him, and considering the transmission of this evidence assists in rediscovering the context in which his work was appreciated in the past and how this may temper modern appreciation of his efforts. At the very least, however, we can finally confirm Hartlib as one of the most prolific intelligences of the 17th century, and we no longer have cause to doubt the following statement of his rarely rivaled epistolary tenacity. I have one fault, if it be a fault, to write commonly very largely, and it may be my friends think themselves excused if they do not answer to all my particulars, but they shall not escape me so. Now that they know the extent of my work, they must think of me rather differently. Thank you.